Okay, just two corrections, or one correction and one clarification of what I said last week. And speaking quickly, I referred to Belz as being in Hungary. It actually, of course, is in Poland or near the Ukraine. The reason I thought Hungary, just speaking quickly, is if we ever do the Belzers, there's the famous story that Belz Rebbe was in Hungary at the end of the war, and from Hungary he goes to the land of Israel, and that's a major controversy in and of itself, because his brother gave a sermon there telling them that nothing would happen, everything would be fine, there's no Zionists in Hungary, and this drasha was then censored when it was reprinted. The other thing is, someone wanted some clarification on the situation in Vilna, because I spoke a bit about what happened with Vilna right before the war. The situation was as follows, just briefly. Kovno, Kaunas, was the capital of Lithuania in the interwar years. Lithuania was an independent country. Vilna was part of Poland. That's just the way it was divided. Once the war began, the Soviets came in and they occupied Vilna just very briefly. They gave it back to Lithuania, and in exchange they moved in and took over a good portion of Lithuanian territory, and that's part of the territory they took over was Kletsk, which is why the Kletsk Yeshiva had to flee to Vilna. I ended last class. We were talking about how the Haredim were really a meaningless component until the late 1970s. The Aguda had only a few seats. They were always in the opposition. I mentioned that there was a draft exemption for the yeshiva students, but there weren't that many in terms of number. In the late 1970s, the population really begins to grow. Until the late 1970s, believe it or not, B'nai Brak was controlled by the National Religious Party. Incidentally, those if you don't want to see all these other squares, you can enlarge me or you can box them up if it bothers anyone. National Religious Party controlled B'nai Brak. There were many what we would call religious Zionist Jews living in B'nai Brak in the 1970s. The Begin comes to power in 1979, and this was a government that was much more friendly to the Haredim. Massive government aid starts flowing to the Haredim. They always received some aid, but much more than before. The Haredi population is growing in great numbers, and an ethos begins to develop, or I shouldn't say begins to develop, because it had been there, but it never was any... But beginning in the late 70s, the ethos starts really in the world, which is growing, that every Haredi young man must go to yeshiva and stay in yeshiva permanently, basically, unless you're a loser or something. So you have something in the late 90s of an entire society in which basically none of the young people go to work, certainly none of them go to the army. Before this time, you had people going to the army because you had these groups, I guess you called them semi-Haredim, not real Haredim like we would call today, but the semi-Haredim. They go to yeshiva, then they go to the army, things like that. Now you have a real movement, what today we call Haredi Judaism. It wasn't called that then. It wasn't a movement like we think of today, where to be a member of the Haredi world, you had to go to yeshiva, and you could not go to the army. And I mean never go to the army. And of course, that's the problem today. Where it'll end, no one knows. 11% of young Israeli men, 18-year-olds, got the exemption last year. And every year, the exemption is bigger and bigger. How long can this go on? When it's 20%, 25%, it'll be... Right now, I read the statistic that of the 6-year-olds, so there's people going into first grade, 25% of them are Haredi. So in another 12 years, you're going to have one quarter people getting the draft exemption. That's, you can't have a society like that. Why should anyone else in the country, religious or non-religious, send their sons to the army if one quarter of the population is taking the draft exemption, the draft dodge? I mean, when it's just it's an impossible situation. They tried with the Nachal Haredi to do something about it, but the Nachal Haredi today is really occupied by pretty much by Hezder people who don't want to be go in Hezder types and Merkaz Harav types. You have very few Haredim in it. So where this will end, it's anyone's guess. But this is when Rav Shach's star really begins to shine. At this time, the two most important leaders in the Lithuanian world were the Gera Rebbe and among the Hasidim and Rav Shach among the Lithuanians. The Stipler was also very important, but by the early 1980s, he's quite old, and he works together with Rav Shach on everything. And at least many people think that Rav Shach was really pushing a lot of these issues. But the Stipler was also very important. The Stipler dies in 1985, and as I said, in the last years, everything was made jointly with Rav Shach, and the Stipler said he wouldn't sign anything without Rav Shach going along with it. The Moetzes Gedolei Torah was controlled. The Aguda has a Moetzes Gedolei Torah, which is a council of Torah sages. It's controlled by two people. Rav Shach, representing the Litvisha world, and the Hasidisha world is the Gera Rebbe. Now, this is a scenario for conflict for a few reasons. First of all, having a Litvisha, a Lithuanian, and a Hasidic leader, where neither of them is able to dominate the other, is going to create conflict. The non-Hasidim are always going to follow Rav Shach, and the Hasidim are always going to follow the Gera Rebbe. And truthfully, the whole notion of a Moetzes Gedolei Torah is a fiction and has always been a fiction. Zvi Weinman, who himself is a Haredi, he's a historian. He's a Haredi historian. When I say he's a historian, I don't mean like a barrel of wine. He's a historian who works with original documents. He's an anti-Zionist, no question about it. Pretty much a very right-wing Agudist figure. And he's published a few volumes showing really history of Haredi world of orthodoxy, and he has shown, without any doubt question, that Moetzes Gedolei Torah has always been a fiction. What do I mean by a fiction? Yes, there is an organization of great Gedolim that would meet. However, if you look at how decisions were made, there was always one figure, and often this figure didn't attend the meetings. He made the decisions, and the Moetzes was a rubber stamp. It's not like they got together and debated this. In fact, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, I don't even think it's met in the last few years. It's maybe even 5 or 10 years. Rav Yoshev is making all the decisions for the Lithuanian world, and the Ger Rebbe is making the decisions for the Hasidic world. So I guess they came to the conclusion, what's the point in meeting if all the decisions are being made? You don't have any Lithuanian Rabbanim who will go against Rav Shach, or today go against Rav Yoshev. So Weinman has shown that that's always how it's been, that the Moetzes Gedolei Torah has never been an organization in which all the people on it really have authority. In fact, he shows that there are times even when the Rabbanim didn't have the authority, that what today they call the Askanim, the people who, the politicians, went against the Gedolim. He has minutes from Moetzes Gedolei Torah meetings where we see that the politicians went against what they were told to do by the Rabbanim. So it's quite interesting. He has two volumes. I can't remember the names off present. I have them downstairs. If you email me, I'll give them to you. One thick volume. I think the thick volume is called, I don't want to give the names because I'm afraid. His name is Weinman, and I can send it to you. He's, as a profession, he's what they call a Toein Rabbani. You can hire someone to argue for you in rabbinic courts, and that's what he does as a profession. I think he even calls himself a lawyer advocate, but he's just in the Beis Din system. Today there are even women who do this. Rabbi Rotefet's daughter was actually the first woman Toenet. I don't know. If things keep going the way they're going, they're going to ban her. They won't permit any women to do this. Now, there are always disputes between Rav Shach and the Gera Rebbe, in particular about Poalei Agudas Yisrael. There was an organization of Agudistin which really broke away and formed something called Poalei Aguda, which was, they were more moderate. They were the workers, had a socialist mentality. They established a couple kibbutzim. And they broke with Aguda on some important issues in terms of joining the government and other things. There were also cultural issues. Rav Simcha Bunim Alter, he's known as the Lev Simcha, the Gera Rebbe, was not known as the greatest of Lamdanim. I mean, he's a Talmud Chacham, of course. The Gera have always been Talmud Chachamim. And he's famous for instituting the Daf Yomi for the Yerushalmi. The Gera Hasidim do a Daf Yomi for Yerushalmi. But it's always been hard for the Lithuanian Rabbanim to relate to these Hasidic leaders as equals. Because, let's remember, a Hasidic Rebbe is chosen because he's a son or a son-in-law. And he's put on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah because he can deliver votes, because he has a following. But for a Lithuanian Rav who's there and who's recognized because of his learning and his ability in Torah, to be together with someone who's there for Yerusha, who's there because of inheritance, it's hard to get along, and this is not going to impress. A Hasidic Rebbe doesn't impress a Lithuanian unless the Hasidic Rebbe is also a great Talmud Chacham. Now, this tension. Yes, now, unfortunately, you do have Rosh Yeshiva chosen by nepotism. But I'll say that if you look at the yeshivas, where this Pebble of Tells, for example, we mentioned this a few times in Cleveland. There's an example of where yeshiva, half the school is empty and people aren't going there, and that's because they don't have the best faculty. If a yeshiva chooses people based on nepotism, you're not going to have a good faculty necessarily, and people will stop coming, unless you're a place like Lakewood. Lakewood is such a phenomenon that the fact that no one considers the Rosh Yeshiva the same level as another yeshiva, as well, it's still a phenomenon. Maybe that's the same thing in Mir as well. But the typical yeshiva, and maybe even Ponevez, which is all nepotism, but the typical yeshiva, I would say, if you don't have good rebbes, who's going to go there? There's still a free market system, and I think people go to Lakewood. The typical person in Lakewood never hears a shir from the Rosh Yeshiva. There's plenty of chaburas. There's like 10 or 20 different chaburas by great Torah scholars who themselves could be Rosh Yeshiva. They're there to learn. They're there for the atmosphere. But I do think in general, and they don't see the Rosh Yeshiva as their leader. So I think in general, though, you need the good Rosh Yeshiva, or you're not going to have, people aren't going to go to the yeshiva, and the yeshiva will be empty. Look, I was in Skokie this Shabbos. Skokie's a perfect example. Skokie used to have Gedola Yisrael, or of Kreisworth, of Chaim Zimmerman, or Aaron Soloveitchik, or Regensburg, etc. Great, now the yeshiva, basically, it's a shell. They don't know what to do. They don't know if they should go more Haredi. That'll attract people. Go less Haredi. The bottom line is you need faculty, and nepotism won't work in the Litvish world. So, Rav Shach had enormous slumdumbness. We're going to get to that. That's part of the problem, that he found it difficult to be with these others. I'll get to Rav Shach slumdumbness soon. This tension between the Hasidic world and the Lithuanian world was kept under the table, was kept under control for two generations by the leaders of the Lithuanian world, and the leaders of the Hasidic world were able to compromise and keep it under control. There even was one newspaper, Hamodia, which was able to satisfy both sides. Rav Shach's legacy, for good or for bad, and this depends on your perspective, is that it's under his watch, and because of him, that this modus vivendi broke apart. And today, Hasidim and Misnagdim are very far apart, and are at each other's throats half of the time, and there's even been real hatred over the years. In recent years, they've once again decided to join together on one parliamentary ticket, but who knows how long that will last. And as we'll see in a few minutes, it's not just with Ger that Rav Shach felt he had to take a stand, it was with Lubavitch. And that is where we'll see he was very influential. And when it came to Chabad, Rav Shach was able to force an issue to the fore, to the front burner, that the other Gedolim had been very happy to keep on the back burner in order to preserve Shalom Bayis, peace in the community. Now, we don't have time to go into the details, so let me quickly summarize and then pick up the story. Rav Shach, in the 1980s, sees that the value system and the ideals and the political ideals, especially between the Lithuanian world and the Hasidic world, are very different. Rav Shach, for example, was very much on the left politically in terms of giving back land. He was opposed to settlements. Emmanuel, there's a Haredi settlement, Emmanuel, in that I think it was the first Haredi settlement in Yehuda and Shomron. He was against that. The Ger Rebbe was not so much against this. Rav Shach wanted very much a compromise. There were other issues. There was fights over who were going to represent the Aguda party at the top of the ticket. Rav Shach realized, and he didn't think that enough respect was being given to the Lithuanian world. The first thing he did was he uses Rav Avadi Yosef. He calls in Rav Avadi Yosef, and at this time he's the patron, and convinces him to open up, start a new party. The party had begun by itself in Jerusalem as a local party, turned it into a national party, the Shas party. And as we spoke about in our talks on Rav Avadia, in a few years Rav Avadia realizes that he has all this authority. He doesn't need to follow Rav Shach, and although Rav Shach gives an order not to join a coalition, Rav Avadia goes against this order, and he becomes the most important Orthodox political figure. That's when Rav Shach creates his own party, the party of the Lithuanians, the Degel HaTorah party. Well, Rav Shach realized that there was an enormous, and he realized correctly, he's very intelligent, that there's an enormous unrealized mass of traditionalist Sephardi voters who recognize and respect Torah authority. They were all voting for Likud. When Shas is created, it very quickly becomes the third largest party in Israel. I think at its height, it had 17 seats. After Likud and Labor, this was the most important party because all these Sephardim, these traditionalist Sephardim, were voting for it, even though they themselves were not Shomer Shabbos. And Rav Shach recognized that. And Rav Avadia recognized it too. There's no need to take orders from anyone else. So Rav Shach forms the Degel Torah party, which is the Litvisha party, the Lithuanians, they get a few seats, Aguda gets a few seats. Rav Shach creates a newspaper called Yated Ne'aman, which very quickly begins to outsell Hamodia. There's an English version of it, although they're not officially connected. They pretty much are the same ideology. Although I will say that the Yated Ne'aman is more respectful to, let's say, Rav Soloveitchik, the American Yated Ne'aman. And this becomes a force to be reckoned with. As I said, they're able to join together with the Aguda a few years back to form one parliamentary coalition, but the disputes still remain, and Rav Shach is the one who revived the Hasidic Mishnadic dispute. Why? What's going on? Well, this is my understanding of all this. The Haredi community today does not feel that it's in an ideological battle with the non-religious. In their mind, they've won that battle. They look around, there's the Zionist malaise, post-Zionism, Yerida from the non-religious, I don't know, does Ehud Barak, Olmert, do any of their children live in Israel? There's a feeling among the that Zionism is at an end. Look with the disengagement, with Gush Emunim, their failures. The Haredim really have a triumphalist feeling that they are in charge. They've begun taking control of the Batei Din, the chief rabbinate. As such, they no longer have this outer battle to wage. They can now turn inwards and attempt to create an ideologically pure society, which they never could before because they always were involved in controversies and compromises, etc. And I think what we've seen in the last few years in places like Beit Shemesh and elsewhere is that now they've been able to turn internally to create this pure Haredi society. They've turned on each other. And the machlokas has been incredible. If you look at the yeshivas like Ponevezh and elsewhere, no longer fighting an outer enemy, they punish every small deviance, every small divergence from the new party line. And the list of those who suffered is long. It's everyone from Slifkin to Kamenetsky to Rav Abadi to Lipa Schmelzer to the other Orthodox performers. There is a real, the people who think that it's okay to sit with their wives on the buses. I mean, they have begun turning on each other because now they're no longer fighting the outer enemy. It's like, why do the Hasidim and Misnagdim turn against each other now? When they were fighting the Maskilim, when they were fighting the modern Orthodox Zionists, they were united front. They were busy fighting the outer enemy. Now that that battle has been won, victory, they can now begin to look at what divides themselves. That's always an issue. I think that really explains why now we see such inner tension and the cherims and the inner battles in the Haredi world. It's because there no longer is the unity they had when feeling they were threatened from the outer world. They're confident enough that they can now fight among themselves. Only if you're confident about the outside world do you fight among yourselves. Rav Shach's other battle, great battle, was with Chabad. And here, too, you can see him as either terribly misguided or as a real prophet. It's no secret that there were those in the Litvisha world who were anti-Chabad. Rav Aaron Cutler was very anti-Chabad from the beginning. The Brisker Rav, anti-Chabad, or both. Rav Huttner, anti-Chabad, vocally so. However, Rav Shach took it to another level. In addition, Rav Shach was alive when the Messianic fever really began. But to his credit, I think you can say that he saw this coming even before the Messianic fever began, and that is even before there were public declarations that the Rebbe was the Messiah. The public declarations that the Rebbe was the Messiah only came in the last years of the Rebbe's life. Yes, before David Berger, a long time. Berger didn't start till after the Rebbe's death. I mean, this is, look, now we live with this. This appeared in the New York Times, I think it's on column 08, a full page ad, which I think cost $150,000, about bringing Mashiach. Interestingly enough, in this ad, it doesn't say the Rebbe's Mashiach in English. You could read this and have no clue that it's a messianic group, but if in Hebrew, you could see the declaration. I'm just thinking, with $150,000, they could give every teacher at the local yeshiva here, what, a $2,000, a $3,000 raise, and I think it's a better money better spent than this, and I don't know who gives the charity for this. But a week before this appeared, some of you probably saw the ad in New York Times, which was not so careful. That is, which an ad like this is on two levels. To the wider world, they don't spout the messianism. They keep it hidden. But for those who can read Hebrew, there's the messianic Yechiyah Adonai Mareinu Melech HaMashiach. A week prior, there was a half a page ad in which it talks about long live King Messiah, the whole business. Now, in the earlier years, that is, in the 1980s, you didn't have the Rebbe proclaimed publicly as Messiah. You had unofficial publications, but nothing official. What was going on, though, was the Rebbe was being treated as more than human, that is, as some sort of Superman, not called Messiah, but there was a lot of suspicion, and truthfully, I can tell you that I was wrong, because I remember being at a Chabad house in about 1989, and I was told that people do not believe the Rebbe's Mashiach. And I knew there were some people who did, and I thought that they were an extremist group, a fringe group, some crazies. Now I believe that, really, I don't know if this person at the Chabad house in Boston knew whether he believed the Rebbe was Mashiach or not, but I believe that all the powers and everyone who knew what was going on in Chabad, they believed the Rebbe was Mashiach, but they wouldn't say so publicly. So it wasn't that it was a fringe group, it was that this was a teaching that was a secret teaching, and it could be that this Chabad guy in Boston wasn't let in on the teaching. He didn't know that this was the teaching, or it could be that he knew when he was just following the party line. It's hard to say. Okay, before we go on, Rabbi Hirsch asks about the American Haredim. American Haredim have a very hard time because the Aguda in America, it has both Hasidim and Misnagdim. The Aguda in America refused to take a stand. They sat out this entire battle, and when the Aguda in America would go to Israel, they'd go meet with the Ger Rebbe, and they'd meet with Rav Shach. They didn't get involved in this, and they were very clear that they were being neutral. I think it's obvious that the Aguda in America was run by the Lithuanians for the most part, and politically they didn't want to alienate the Hasidim. If you go to the Aguda convention, it's much more Lithuanian. But the typical American Haredim, the Lithuanians, they obviously were on Rav Shach's side. He was the most important figure. What else would the Chabad do? Well, for example, they would talk about Mashiach. And sometimes they would use this expression, we want Mashiach Mamash. You know, we have to bring Mashiach Mamash. And sometimes they would even give it away. They would put three dots, a dot over the mem, the shin. And if you know what the three dots means, it means, what is this, what does mem, mem, shin stand for? Menachem Mendel Schneerson. So if you go back to the 80s, all this talk about we want Mashiach Mamash, what that meant is we want Mashiach Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Again, you had to know what this meant. Not everyone knew, and not every Chabad knew. Certainly people on the outside didn't know. The Chabadniks were using all sorts of terms about their Rebbe, calling him Nasi Hador, the prince, the president of the generation, the great one. Really elaborate and highfalutin terms. They're not all Mashiachists. It's a good question. I don't know if they're all Mashiachists or not. I'm assuming some are not. I know some who are not. But it's hard to know because there are the open Mashiachists, and then there are the ones who are not open Mashiachists, and yet some of the ones who are not open Mashiachists are really believers, but they don't believe you should publicize it. For example, my kids went to the Dan Yisrael camp in Morristown, which is the Chabad school, it's the Lubavitch Rabbinical College. I personally don't care because all they learned there was Shabbos, Kashrus, they didn't talk about Messianism, but as far as I know, half these people do believe. I didn't care because as long as they're not talking about it, it didn't concern me. But we know that there are many who believe that this isn't something that you stress, but you still believe it. David Berger has said that he has not been able to find a Chabad figure who is willing to say the Rebbe is not the Messiah. So in other words, you have those who say he is, and you have those who don't say anything, but we don't have any major figures yet who have, and I'm talking about the non-Messianists, Krinsky, the rest of them in Crown Heights, the ones who went to court to, you know, to fight, to take, because the Messianists were controlling 770. When I say Messianists, I mean the crazies, the one who, you can see videos, I can send you links, where they spread like the Red Sea, and they allow the Rebbe to walk through. And you can watch the Rebbe walking through. Of course, you're not watching anything. They answer to his brachas. They have a chair for the Rebbe where he sits there. They give him aliyahs. I'm talking about today. They do this sort of thing. They answer to his Kaddish. Those are the real crazies who the mainstream Chabad wanted out, and there's this court case going on. But even the non-crazies, they have never yet declared that he's not the Mashiach, so it's really hard to know what's going on in there. But getting back to Rav Shach, Rav Shach declared from the 1980s that Chabad is a cut. What's a cut? A cut is a sect. And this is a very dangerous language, because this is the same language that the people in the era of the Vilna Gaon used to refer to Hasidim as a whole. When you say that something's a cut, you mean that it's not really Jewish. The famous expression that, it's the closest religion to Judaism. This was enormously controversial, and he was saying it at a time when no one else. And remember, you had great Lithuanian Rabbanim who were very close to Chabad. Rav Moshe Feinstein, just to give one great example, was very close to Lubavitcher Rebbe, had a great deal of respect, did not share any of these feelings of Rav Shach. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik went to a firm break, and he never had these feelings about Chabad. You had Rav Gedalia Shor. When the Rebbe was sitting Shiva, Rav Gedalia Shor of the Rosh Yeshiva Tzar V'Das went to be Menachem Avil. Rav Shach tried to stop him. He said, "You can't go be Menachem Avil, the leader of the Kat." So you have Lithuanian Gedolim who did not see it the same way. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach never saw it this way. His son-in-law, Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, to this day, is the one who gives the smicha to the Chabadniks. So the Lithuanian world was split over this. And there's a great video, by the way, of one of the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Arieli's son-in-law, coming to the Rebbe to talk to him about these things, because what they're saying in the Lithuanian world, and the Rebbe's response, and explaining all these things. So the Litvisha world was split over this issue completely. Yes, Rav Gedalia Shor did go. Anyway. But Rav Shach didn't care. He spoke his mind. And he felt that you need to be honest in saying that what Rav Shach was afraid of actually came to fruition to a significant extent. Rav Shach, it's unimaginable 20 years ago to think that there could be a movement that believes in a dead Messiah, that has a dead Messiah as their leader, that is still part of mainstream Judaism. And yet it exists, and I think this shows something very interesting that Rav Shach, I guess, was very concerned with, that at the end of the day, it's about halachic observance. Berger's book is entitled The Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, and the fact is that the Gedolim have concluded, almost without exception, they have not followed Rav Shach's line. The Gedolim have basically have concluded that although this is a foolish belief and we have to feel sorry for these people and try to change their mind, they're not heretics, they're not a cop, they're not out of the fold, they're just very misguided people. What this shows is that at the end of the day, it's Jewish law that matters, not really what you believe, if you're not violating any like real red lines. Think back to the rise of Christianity. Had the early Christians not accepted Jesus as God, because at their first they didn't, had they simply accepted him as Messiah, and had they not gotten rid of Jewish law, as Paul did, it would have remained part of mainstream Judaism. And I think that's the lesson here, that as long as you observe Jewish law, Jewish theology is much broader than anyone thought 15 years ago. In fact, after this happened, someone wrote to me and says that this is a big proof to your book, that it shows that it's really about halacha, it's not theology, but Rav Shach did not believe this. Rav Shach believed that this was a cot, and this was a sectarian movement, and we need to stop it. Incidentally, I'll tell you that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky agreed with Rav Shach, and he broke from the Agudas Rabbanim in America over this. And in Nussan Kamenetsky's book, he quotes Rav Yaakov saying that the only reason Rav Moshe Feinstein is so friendly to Chabad and tolerant is because he never went to Slobodka. He never had a Musa Rebbe. He never had the altar. If he had, then he would have seen the danger of Chabad. But look, Rav Moshe had a very different view on this. And Rav Shach's attacks on Chabad with the Haredi world, especially since so many Hasidim supported Chabad. Now, these Hasidim, if you know the Hasidic world, you basically have Hasidim and Chabad. Chabad is a completely separate Hasidus. It's always been. They have their own canon of books, which they, you can spend your whole life just learning Chabad literature. And I don't just mean Tanya, I mean all the Rebbes. They've been enormously prolific. The last Lubavitcher Rebbe has something like, what, 45, 50 volumes of Likutei Sichot? Yet if you're another type of Chassid, you have a whole library. You read the books of the Chernobyl dynasty and the Teitelbaums and all. Chabad is separate. However, at the end of the day, they're still Hasidim. And the other Hasidim, although they're very distant from Chabad, when they saw Rosh Hashanah attacking them, they went to the defense. And Agudas Yisrael, which was then controlled by the Hasidim after Rosh Hashanah left, they became a pro-Chabad movement, and the from Jewry was really split. This led to Rav Shach being seen as an enemy of Chabad, of Hasidus, not just Chabad. In fact, in his book, which I showed you last week, Amita Shel Sheker, it talks about his Melchama b'Chasidim b'chal u'b'kvod k'doshas Maran Admar Milubavitch b'frat. So the Hasidim saw this as a battle against Hasidus as a whole. Now Rav Shach always insisted that he was not against Hasidus. In fact, he went so far as to say, someone said to him that in Olam Haba, the Vilna Gaon is going to praise you and is going to want to come give you a big Yasha Koach for taking on Chabad. He said, it's not the Vilna Gaon, the Baal HaTanya will come, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, because Rav Shach was very clear that Chabad has not just distorted Hasidus, it's distorted Chabad. Rav Shach said that Chabad is a precious and a valuable movement, but the current Rebbe has distorted it and turned it into a sect. That's not how it played out in the real world, though. How it was played out was that Rav Shach was driven by typical misnagid antipathy to Hasidus, and the language, Hasidim began using the language again of misnagdim, foolish misnagdim. They never used that language before, and they began referring to stupid misnagdim, things like that. I have to say that I believe Rav Shach is correct, though. I have gone through all of his writing, and I've never seen an attack against Hasidus as a whole. Granted, he's no fan of Hasidus. This isn't his way of life. However, I have seen no attack on the value system, on the lifestyle of Hasidus as a whole. There have been attacks on Hasidus. In fact, there's a guy in Lakewood who published a vicious pamphlet, more than a pamphlet, like 80 pages, against Hasidus. It's like he's in the 18th century, just attacking everything about Hasidus, the Rebbes, the this and that. Rav Shach never did this. He stuck to Chabad, and to a certain extent he stuck to Ger, although without getting into specific in Ger, but, code words, those people don't listen to Das Torah, etc. You can read it as an attack on Ger. His followers took up the anti-Chabad cause, and they went even further. They began to point out halachic violations in the Chabad camp. Now, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself commented, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said this has to come from sinah, from hate, because these practices of Chabad are very old. They go back, who knows how long, 100 years, they don't go back to the beginning, but none of the other Gedolim, Reb Chaim Moshe Grodzinski and the other Gedolim never attacked this. It's only in the current generation. For example, Chabad do not believe in sleeping in the sukkah. They have a whole Kabbalistic thing that, we're not holy enough to sleep in the sukkah. They don't believe in eating Sudash Lishit. There's other things as well. And there are polemics, there's contracing, there's books that attack them for this. In fact, at times it seems that Rav Shach was criticizing Chabad just for the sake of criticizing him. Sometimes there's no question that his criticism is valid. At other times, it seems it was just for the sake of criticizing. For example, he has a number of letters attacking the Chabad movement's Rambam Yomi. The Chabad began this thing called Learn a Parak of Rambam, a chapter of Maimonides, Mishnah Torah a day. This is obviously in opposition, I guess, to the Daf Yomi, which was more of a Lithuanian sort of thing. Okay, so you learn if the Ger Rebbe can institute Yerushalmi and other people have Tanakh Yomi, what's wrong with learning Rambam a day? Rav Shach attacks them, and the reason for his attack is quite interesting. He says that we don't paskin like the Rambam, and therefore Balabatim, who only have a little bit of time. They shouldn't be wasting their time learning the Rambam when all they're going to get is theoretical. They should learn Mishnah Berurah. They should learn practical halacha. Makes a lot of sense. You can even find the Prisha on the Torah says that if you only have a little bit of time each day, you should learn practical halacha. We can understand that. However, the very same criticism could be given against Daf Yomi. All these people, the only learning they do every day, they do their 45 minutes or an hour, they're doing Daf Yomi, which also has no practical halacha implications. You could take Rav Shach's letters, he has like 5 or 6 of them, and substitute Daf Yomi and get to the exact same thing. And if everyone thinks Daf Yomi is such a great thing, and people sit and studying Daf Yomi is okay, and no one's criticizing these people because they're not learning practical halacha, I don't see how you can criticize Lubavitch for learning Rambam. That's just as theoretical as learning Daf of Gemara. So I think in that area, it's his criticism of Chabad really became too much. And it got to the point where he was criticizing whatever they were doing. Now, for the most part, Chabad did not respond to the attacks directly. There is a very learned attack on Rav Shach Sefer. Rav Shach has a number of volumes called Avi Ezri, which are his books on the Rambam. And there's no question, everyone's in agreement. I even asked a Hasidish guy a few weeks ago who was no fan of Rav Shach, because I don't feel that I'm, you know, capable of evaluating it this way, but this person, he works for the Art Scroll Gemara, I mean, a huge Talmud Chacham, and he said that there's no question that the Avi Ezri, Rav Shach's work, really reaches the heights of traditional Lithuanian Torah study. The Brisker Rav himself thought so, and he gave one of the few approbations the Brisker Rav gave. So we're dealing with someone who is really at the highest of the high levels of learning. And yet there is a Chabad figure, a Talmud Chacham, who did attack it, but this wasn't a common thing. You know, it raises all sorts of questions, and this is why the Haredi world was in such a problematic place. According to the Halacha, this is brought down the Rambam, elsewhere, what's the definition of Apikoros? The definition of Apikoros is one who degrades a Talmud Chacham. And we're obligated to put someone in Chayrim if you degrade a Talmud Chacham. So here you have a real problem. It really came to the fore, especially with the end of the Eibshitz dispute. Let's say you're in the 18th century, and you're a fan of Rav Yonason Eibshitz, who was regarded as the Gadol Hador, and Rav Yaakov Emden attacks him as a heretic. Apparently, according to the Halacha, you'd have to put Yaakov Emden in Chayrim and treat him like he's a heretic, and like you can't count to a minion, you can degrade him. Of course, you can't do that, because then everyone's going to be putting everyone in Chayrim. I actually asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik this question, just because I was curious to see what his answer would be, because he is obviously an Ish Halacha, he was an Ish Halacha, and he was also a great fan of Lubavitcher Rebbe. I said to him, there is a halacha that if someone defames a Torah scholar, we must treat him like he's a heretic. And I said that Rav Shach has defamed the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And since you think, I can't believe I would ask this thing. I mean, it's a little bit of a chutzpah question maybe, but I really was curious because this is constantly an issue. Today, you know, when the Rabbanim are degrading other Rabbanim left and right, I think Aaron's answer was on the mark. I said, how are we supposed to treat Rav Shach? Because according to the Rambam, we have to treat him. I mean, I was acting on Rav Aaron's assumption that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is one of the Gadol Yisro, etc., etc. How can we give Rav Shach respect anymore? We have to treat him like, he's an evil person. And Rav Aaron replied that we can no longer apply this Rambam anymore. He says, we can't do this anymore. But his attitude was the same. You'll see in Yehurath Lehenkin's B'nai Vanim, Volume 3, he's asked the question, how do you relate to the Satmar Rebbe? Because the Satmar Rebbe is degrading Gedolei Yisrael. And Rav Yehuda Arutz Lehenkin says that follow the Rambam. The Rambam says you should be degraded, but not degrade back. It's interesting, though, because the halacha is clear about how you have to treat someone who degrades a Torah scholar. But Rav Aaron said to me that when you have Gedolei Yisrael fighting like this, our job is simply to stay on the side and not interfere. But you can see why people on the Lubavitcher Rebbe's side would react to Rav Shach the way they did, because it's their Rebbe who's being attacked. So it's very, why can't we apply it anymore? Rav Aaron thought, because his position was that Rav Shach is a Gadol Yisrael, and he's doing this authentically, and we should not get involved with this, and today it would create machlokas left and right, because because then we would degrade Rav Shach. And then Rav Shach's Talmidim, who are also Gedolei Yisrael, would have to degrade Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and our Rebbe. Everyone would be degrading everyone else. We'd be hating everyone else. It can't work. What do you do with the Rambam then? I don't know. It just can't work. It can work if you have maybe one Rav who does crazy things, but when the whole world, the Jewish world, would be split. Revaron didn't really have an answer. He simply said, we can't do this anymore. And this isn't the first generation. We've had generation upon generation now where we couldn't do this. And this is, yes, this is the approach of the YU Ravain. I wouldn't say Nidkat Nodor in terms of Machokas, but how, realistically, how can we start? Every one time a certain Rav degrades another Rav, we then have to treat him like we degrade him. And, I mean, it's Engladov herself. It would be terrible. Yes, Rav Shach did criticize Rav Adya's method of learning, but that's a criticism. That's not degrading. I mean, he's not calling Rav Adya an evil. I don't know if he called the Rebbe evil. He thought the Rebbe was terribly misguided. But he said the Rebbe, the movement, and he's the Rebbe's ahead of a cut, and this and that. He did criticize, but he's criticized other people as well. I'll tell you. I'll get into some of them right now. The Rebbe, though, actually came out against Rav Shach one time. This is quite interesting, quite amazing. Because the Rebbe never responded. The Rebbe didn't believe in responding. But Rav Shach gave a speech in which he said that the reason the Holocaust came about is because the Jews had sinned. Now, this is a very traditionalist perspective. That's why the Holocaust happened. And Rav Shach was simply applying the traditional viewpoint. Today, it's a very difficult thing to say because... even though it was the traditional viewpoint, it doesn't ring true to people. And you're talking a million children, great scholars. I mean, they didn't sin. It's just a hard thing to say. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, without mentioning Rav Shach by name in his Farm Bregen, criticized those who dare to insult and degrade the Kedoshim, the holy ones of the Holocaust. He said, everyone from the Holocaust is pure and is a martyr and is holy, and we can't even begin to raise questions as to why this happened. It's not for us. Basically, the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave the answer of Job. You know, the answer of Job was that we cannot give explanations for this. Rav Shach was giving a traditional perspective that despite the Lubavitcher Rebbe's, despite what the book of Job says, Torah leaders have always tried to say that, you know, given reasons for these things, and they continue to give reasons. Yes, the Rav also said we can't give the explanations for these things. And Rav Shach was known for many other extremist statements. He was asked, those who are interested, you can buy Michtavim U'Ma'amarim, like five volumes. In there, he's asked, for example, about the Rav Soloveitchik's views of Zionism. He attacks the Rav. He says that the Rav departed from Das Torah. He says that it's forbidden to read it. He calls it one place, he says it's called Mamash Divrei Kfira. It's literally heresy. As Rav Shach's role was guardian of the Haredi orthodoxy, and he had to do this in his mind. With a stridency, we might find disconcerting, but he had to make sure that the other forms of orthodoxy didn't influence his forms of orthodoxy. The part which was kafira, according to him, is this idea that the non-religious have a significant role. The Rav speaks about, you know, the buildings they're building and all the other things that they're building up the land, and he sees that as, you know, very important. And from Rav Shach's perspective, to give the Zionists any credit is kafira. It doesn't mean kafira in the sense that heresy, that if you hold it, you're a heretic. He's using rhetoric here, saying it's kafira, it's a false opinion. It's an opinion that diverges directly from the Torah view. So often people like him and the Satmar Rebbe use the word kafira loosely. Among other institutions he took issue with and condemned, Torah College, that wanted to open in Jerusalem. Jerusalem College of Technology. Well, that's another thing. By the way, where he says it's Mamash Dibri Kfira, it's not the famous letter that everyone knows. It's another letter. The famous one is that is Chamesh Rashot, where the Rav explained why he became a Zionist. The Rav comes from a family which are not just non-Zionist, anti-Zionist. His grandfather, together with Lubavitcher Rebbe, were the leading anti-Zionists. And the Rav has this beautiful drusha of Joseph and his brothers. The upshot of it is, even though the brothers are the majority, Joseph, which I think means him, maybe, can rule against them because God himself decides. Usually we decide the majority, but God himself came down and decided that Mizrahi is correct. And the Rav broke with Aguda, which makes it much more difficult as well. Yeah, Rav Shach had a great conflict with the Briskers. That was over another thing. That was because the whole play was written on this. That's because the wife of Malkiel Cutler of Lakewood, she didn't want to go back. He wanted to go back to Lakewood and take over the yeshiva when his father died. And this is the granddaughter of the Brisker Rav, and she said she's not allowed to leave Israel. Her grandfather was a big anti-Zionist, but he was a great lover of Israel. He's a greater, quote, Zionist than all the Zionists who live in Chutz Laaretz. She refused to leave, and according to Halacha, she doesn't have to leave. But you can go if you're going to teach Torah, but they said, well, you could teach Torah here in Jerusalem. He left, and he got a Heter Meir Rabbanim, and Rav Shach signed it, and that created the break, because the Briskers said that was it. They washed their hands of Rav Shach after that, because he interfered in what they thought he shouldn't have interfered with. But it's not for ideology, it's more for that. He condemned, that's Machon Lev, he condemned Michala, forbidden to go there. The Ma'arava school, Heichal Shlomo, the Hezder movement, the Steinsaltz Talmud, other books by the author, Yehuda Levy's book, Shari Talmud Torah, which supports Torah Derech Eretz perspective, and others and others. Now, he wasn't really, he was Mishpacha with Aaron Keller. He was very close to Avraham because of his time in Kletzko. What was the family connection? I mentioned, his wife is the nephew of, is the niece of Rav Ishmael Meltzer, is the father-in-law of Avraham, so in that sense, but, all these things he condemned were part of the Orthodox world. And therefore, and they were supported by great scholars. Leo Levy's book has not come over Yaakov Kamenetsky. So we needed to condemn them because so that people in his world, remember this is the B'nai Brak Orthodoxy, they would see these writings and they would assume that these are kosher writings. And this is apart from his attack against the non-religious, such as his famous speech where he refers to them as rabbit eaters and his statement that the Sfaradim are not ready to leave. Although his statement, as I mentioned, when we dealt with Rav Avadia, was taken out of context, because what it meant was that the Sfaradim hadn't had the experience of being with the non-religious Ashkenazim, so they thought that there's really no difference between Yossi Sarid and Yitzhak Shamir. And Rav Shach's point was that we go with the Likud, we go with the Yamin, because the right-wingers have more of a sense of tradition. And as I said, after Shas ends up in the government, where Shulamit Aloni is appointed Minister of Education, it seems that Rav Shach was onto something there. Now, his attacks against Hezder are quite upsetting for, I think, most of us. And let me explain why. He was making it different than the Chazon Ish, and I'm going to speak in a few minutes how he diverged from the Chazon Ish. He diverged in very small ways. The difference was that when the Chazon Ish was writing, the Haredi Judaism was meaningless. It was a tiny group. Now he's on the stage. We'll get to that in a minute. But let me explain to you what his problem with Hezder is. After all, why could you have a problem with Hezder? Here you have guys who, instead of going to the army, are sitting and learning. And they're dividing their time. Isn't that a good thing? Rav Shach would agree that it's a good thing for some people. In fact, he would agree, although he condemns Michala, for a Mizrahi person to go to Michala as opposed to going to a Mamachti Dati, say that's a very good thing. His condemnations, and this is very important, when you read all these condemnations are for his people. If you're a Mizrahi person and you come to him, he's not telling you it's forbidden to go there. Although he uses very harsh language, it's forbidden. He's speaking to his people. I have no doubt that, his granddaughter went to Chorev. I have no doubt, for those people, he's not speaking to those people. In fact, there's a famous story that he once called in some of the Rosh Yeshiva from the B'nai Akiva Yeshivas, because he read in the newspaper that on Yom HaTzmaut they were having a big soccer match. And he said to them that, I don't hold of Yom HaTzmaut, it's not a holiday for me. But you who hold of Yom HaTzmaut and think it's important, how could you have soccer game? You should be having a day of Torah or something like that. And these Rosh Yeshiva, B'nai Akiva Rosh Yeshiva, actually at the B'nai Akiva convention, they repeated what Rav Shach said, and the people listened. So when he says it's forbidden to have anything to do with Yom HaTzmaut, he's speaking to his own people. I mean, he's not a foolish man. Yes, and we'll get back to his family in a few minutes. So what's the problem with Hezder from Rav Shach's perspective? The problem is that Hezder became an ideal. And if anyone has any doubts about it, read Rav Lichtenstein's famous essay, The Ideology of Hezder. Hezder is an ideal. It's the best thing. It combines service and Torah study. Rav Shach would agree that for those who can't sit in a real yeshiva and are going to the army, that combining army and Torah study is a good thing. But Hezder is an ideology. The problem with Hezder is it doesn't see itself as second rate. It doesn't see the Hezder guys as a bunch of losers. It sees itself as a lechatchila. For Rav Shach, Hezder only would work if it's for the Haredi dropouts, when everyone would know what type of kids go there. Hezder must be regarded as second-rate Torah study. He writes how Hezder destroyed the striving for godless in Torah. In Rav Shach's mind, why does it destroy the striving? Because it puts another value in the mix. The value to serve in the army. Chesed. That's how Aaron Lichtenstein uses the word chesed. To serve the community. They need to be part of wider society and assume obligations. This is a watered-down notion of what a yeshiva is, and is no different than creating a yeshiva with secular studies. Now, at the end of the day, I think most people listening to these lectures now and on tape are going to conclude and believe at present that the Haredi mentality is incredibly selfish. They don't have any identification with, they don't feel any responsibility for larger community or national values. But from the Haredi perspective, they are representatives of the highest value. And it shows a lack of Torah values on the part of others, on the part of the rest of the population, that they expect and want the Haredi youth to go to the army. The Haredim, they're not Satmar. They agree that there's a need for an army. They daven for the army when there's a war. They won't daven during the week because that's politically connected, but if there's a war, they'll say Tehillim for the army. They know you need an army, but it's not their role. They're the Yechidei Sgula. They're the tribe of Levi. They're the special ones. And they'll say that, look, we all know that the streets need to be cleaned, but we don't want our kids to do that. We want our kids to go and get a degree and get a good job. And they say the same thing. They are the special ones. It's not their calling to do this. Now, of course, for the rest of the population, this is blasphemy because army service is not cleaning the streets. That's thought to be a very high thing. But from the Haredi, from Rav Shach's Haredi perspective, army service is for those who are not learning Torah. That's their role. It's a valuable role, but you can't compare it to learning Torah. And he was not shy about explaining exactly where he was coming from, what his ideology was, and this was responsible for much of the tensions in the 80s and 90s between the Haredim and the secularists, which led to the creation of the Shinoi Party. People called it an anti-Orthodox party, about Tommy Lapid's party. It was not anti-Orthodox. They had nothing against Orthodox. It was an anti-Haredi party. And there's a big difference. Why did this only begin in the 1980s? After all, as we're going to see in a few minutes, Rav Shach really carries on with the Chazon Ish's ideology. It's because for the first time we have an ideologue, Rav Shach, who speaks before crowded stadiums. Tens of thousands of people listening to him. Televised live before the entire country. And not afraid to say what he believes. And what he believed and what he thought is not the watered-down Haredism that you often get, especially in America, with all the kollels and the Haredi kollels in America. They give you a watered-down Haredi version. In fact, in a few minutes, and maybe not today, next class, we're going to see Rav Shach's condemnation of these Haredi kollels around America. Precisely, he has a whole condemnation of the Kirov movement, precisely for its watering down of traditional Judaism. He was against the Kirov movement, as we'll see. But this isn't a watered-down Haredi Judaism. This is the authentic thing. This is the real thing. It's very hardcore, and sometimes it's maddening to read. You think you're reading Satmar when you read it. But that's where it is. And I think everyone is aware of the large gap between the American Haredim and the Haredim in Israel. Now, how you view Rav Shach will come down to how you contextualize his condemnations. If you focus on negativity, then you'll conclude, as did the anti-Rav Shach people, especially the Hasidim, that he educated his followers to hatred and machlokas. And this is basic. You look at all the attacks on Rav Shach in the Hasidic world, and there's numerous attacks on him, they all go back to the same thing, that he raised machlokas to new heights. He educated his followers. They gave a chinuch to the young kids, which was against it. Yes, he was against the Art Scroll Gemara. As I'll mention that in a few minutes, he was very much against the Art Scroll Gemara. However, I think this is an unfair criticism of Rav Shach, and it doesn't show the complexity of the situation. There's no question that Rav Shach was a reactionary, but he was defending values of long standing. He didn't make this up. So what others see as his trend to machlokas, this can be reversed, and you could put the onus on the other side. For example, from Rav Shach's standpoint, It's not the, it's the Hezder yeshivas that are to blame. For they changed the traditional form of the yeshiva. It is attack on the Rav. You see the conservative with a small c defending the status quo against the new ideas of the Rav. Let's not forget, it's Mizrahi that's coming with new ideas. He even opposed the Frankel Rambam that everyone uses, and the Stiper has Haskalah, but he opposed it because we don't need new things. He opposed Art Scroll. Why? Because Art Scroll is making Gemara easier for people. And it's not supposed to be easy. Part of Torah study is not just knowing it's not just understanding the sugya, it's the struggle. It's the sweat you go through. A Fumsara Agra. Now, they said he was about to put it in Cherem, but people reached him and convinced him not to. And many people think that the Cherem against Steinsaltz was designed to help Art Scroll. But he was against this. If Gemara and Rashi were good enough for the Bachrim and Yeshiva 30 years ago, we don't need to change that. He was against settling the territories, as I mentioned. If Rav Shach is to be seen, or can be seen, as educating to hatred and machlokes, so can the early opponents of reform, the Chasam Sofer and the rest of them. Anytime a conservative stands his ground and protests changes taking place in society, he's always going to be accused of being closed-minded. Rav Shach would agree with Chesterton, the great Chesterton, who wrote this wonderful book called Orthodoxy. You can read it in 2 hours. It's a book on Christian orthodoxy, but every time he mentions Christianity, if you substitute Judaism, it'll be a wonderful book. And in my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I think that I speculate that maybe Weinberg had read Chesterton and was using some of his ideas. This is what Chesterton wrote, quote, "Progress should mean that we are always changing the world to fit the vision. Instead, we are always changing the vision." In other words, we should be changing the world to fit our vision, not changing our vision to fit the world. Rav Shach could agree with this. He could also agree with Chesterton's other famous comment, quote, "Men invent new ideals because they dare not attempt old ideals. They look forward with enthusiasm because they are afraid to look back." We should be looking back. We should not invent new ideals. We should be attempting the old ideals. We're afraid to try the old ideals, but the old ideals worked. That's Rav Shach's perspective. That's what Chesterton's speaking about. That's what it means to be a traditionalist. Do the Kenepi are having jobs? Well, he said that. He writes in his letters that no one should get a job. And it's amazing. He says, they asked him, well, what about in Europe? You had jobs. He says, as long as we can be supported by the government and other people can support us and we can learn, then we'll learn. He's not an idiot. He says, if we know our can be supported, then you'll have to go out and work. But as long as we can be supported, our job is to stay and learn Torah, and you're not going to be rich. So, you know, you can't blame him. The government is giving all this money. If the government were to stop it, they'd go to work. But Rav Shach said, his attitude was, the government gives us this. They want something we have, namely our votes. And as long as we can make these deals, for Americans, well, he really isn't speaking for Americans. I mean, he gets a lot of money for Americans, but in theory, Americans also. If you can sit and learn, that's the best thing. Yes, not only did he condemn Begin's decision to go to war, it wasn't his dovish position itself which created the controversy. What created the controversy, when he first became known as a dove, the Labor Party was very happy because they said, we found a kindred spirit. But then when they heard him explain it, he said that we should relate to the world like the peasant in Poland danced before the Polish lord. In other words, he said he developed this whole theory that we're in Gullus here. We have to dance before the Americans and the British and everything. So when the Labor Zionists heard this, that it wasn't that he was dovish because he had pride in the state of Israel, but that they had to dance before the poets, you know, then they didn't want to, identify themselves anymore. He condemned, he always believed in peace and giving back land, and it's only been very recently that the Haredi world, the street, the Haredi Gedolim have always been dovish. The Haredi street in the last 20 years has become very hawkish. They're settling in the territories. There's a real disconnect now between the street, and it's curious to see whether they can bring the street with them if they need to. Rav Avadya Yosef was able to bring the Sephardi street with him, at least a good portion of it, and he was dovish. It remains to be seen. Two more minutes, because I do want to conclude with one thing, which I think is important, that despite Rav Shach's condemnations of everything, since he was only regarded as a leader by the Haredi world, the wider Orthodox world didn't really give his pronouncements much regard. And I think it's a testament to the great respect that the wider Orthodox world had for his Torah learning, that despite the fact that he subjected to abuse all these various groups, and you could say, well, he, at the end of the day, he's really only speaking to his followers, but there's ways to say it. Other Gedolim didn't speak like this, didn't talk about how Hesder is destroying Torah study, didn't attack the Rav. The fact is, he was not subjected to abuse in return, with the exception of Chabad. The religious Zionist community continued to give him kavod, respect. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who was, we'll get to, was one of the only Rabbanim who attacked him. But even he, when he heard one of his students criticizing Rav Shach, he was very sharp. He said, what I can do, you can't do. And that we must respect all Torah scholars. And I think that's to the credits of the modern community, the religious Zionist community, that they've always taught the need to respect all Torah scholars, even those Torah scholars who are saying things very negative to their camp. What we still have to do with Rav Shach, we have a little bit still to do, some, where he gets some of these this ideology, his, and what's his view of Zionism is, and especially when it comes to elections. And then I need to speak a bit about his view of Kirov, because I think you'll find this very interesting. We see Kirov as a very positive thing, a good thing, and yet Kirov, we'll see, is another example of people trying to destroy the striving for Torah greatness. It now becomes an ideal to be involved in Kirov. And for Rav Shach, this is a complete destruction of what it means to be a traditional Torah Jew, that you're supposed to be focused on the Torah community, not the outside community. And, yeah, and then they do, so I think we still have about another half hour, and then a little I want to speak about his family life, because it's so interesting. For, as we mentioned last week, and I'll get a little more detail, for all these condemnations, for being regarded as Mr. Extremism, the one that the Haredi world looked up to as Kanai, his own family did not follow this, and he had close and loving relationships, so it's really a fascinating story. In terms of the ideology, I'll just tell you, a whole book came out a couple of years ago, Isha Hashkafa. Why do they call it Hashkafa? Because that's the term in the Haredi world. They're called the Hashkafistim. In the Atei Ne'eman, they put forth Hashka, the proper Hashkafa, or Das Torah. So you have a whole book on this Hashkafa, and there's other things. Benjamin Brown has a long article. People are only now beginning to examine his influence, and a poll was taken last week, I saw in Haaretz, and he was listed as one of the top 10 people informing the image of the state, which I don't think is off the mark, because the Haredi position today was really formed through him. So we still have about a half hour left to go with him. And then next class, by the way, we're not going to go to the Nazir, because I want to make sure we have time. We'll go to Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and if we have time, we'll get to the Nazir. If not, in the future class, certainly. Let me answer some of the questions here, comments. We're taking long. It's a such a fascinating figure. Let's see. We will talk. I spoke a little bit about the last class about his relationship to his children and his child, his son. His daughter remains in the Haredi world, marries a Haredi Rav. It's his son. I'll speak a little bit about his son. Anyone in Israel, you can meet his son, Dr. Ephraim Shach, because it's a very interesting story. And I think it shows Rav Shach as greater than a lot of other Haredi rabbis. And I'll tell you why. I mentioned this last class as well. You have people who get so caught up in their ideology and being an ideologue and attacking the other from an ideological perspective that they lose sight of the human interest. And we've had examples of where they had their own family have been estranged from. And you can understand why. After all, if you're preaching against an ideology and then your children join that, it's a problem. Rav Shach was able to separate the ideology. And it wasn't just with his children, I'll tell you. It was with anyone who went to Rav Shach. If you would have gone to him, Kippah Sergah, etc., he would have treated you wonderfully. The stipor, they say, would have could chase people out of the house. Not Rav Shach, and it's not just his children. He had other family members, his sister, etc. He was really able to separate the two. Now, some people might see this as inconsistent, and see this as hypocritical even, perhaps, that on the one hand, you could be such a burning ideologue, but then in your own life, not really apply it in personal relationships. Some people might see that shows he in his ideology, in his preaching, it really was, he didn't really believe it. But that's not true at all. I think people, sophisticated people, can understand that ideologically you can believe something, and you can also have respect for others, who don't share that position, and certainly if they're your family, you can love and respect them for despite their decisions, which you don't think is necessarily the best approach. So look, even people not in the religious world sometimes can't handle their children's decision and creates breaks. All the more so when, like I said, his granddaughter joined the army. Rashach signed proclamations and preached how this is Yaharig Bel Yavar. You have to give up your life rather than join the army for a girl. And yet he was the most concerned a grandfather could be about his granddaughter, etc., etc. When his granddaughter went to America, she went to Columbia. He was very opposed to it, you know, leaving the land of Israel. And after she explained to him why she needs to go there, she was going to take some education track there. I believe it was education. He was very supportive of it. So, I mean, and we're dealing with a great person. We're dealing with a complicated person. We're dealing with a sophisticated person. So it's he gets a bad rap because people just know about the condemnations, and it's much more complicated than that. And we'll get back a little next class. Well, because why did I say we should break from them? Because you can be respectful and not, just like if you're a Protestant, you can be very respectful of Catholics. I'm respectful of Catholics, too. That does, being respectful of the other side doesn't mean then you have to be craven and not have any ideology of your own. My point there was that you don't have to delegitimize the Haredi Judaism when they do like they do. But that doesn't mean that you can't put forth your own view. Why does everything have to go with them? I mean, they cut out parts of my article where I spoke about how we have kolels, let's say, Haredi kolels in our modern shuls. In Livingston, New Jersey, near me, we have Haredi rabbis who come and speak in our shuls. They'll never let a modern Orthodox rabbi go speak there. They'll never give money. But we accept that. But one thing I don't think you can accept is that this idea that modern Orthodox figures cannot have their own halachic authorities. Why do we need to constantly give in because of unity? Unity. So you could be respectful for their learning, for their great piety, but that doesn't mean that you need to follow their path and constantly give in. You can go your own path. I don't see that as any... there are plenty of Haredim who are respectful for modern Orthodox Gedolim, like Rav Soloveitchik. I won't say it's the dominant view, but you have them, but they don't feel they're their Gedolim. So I don't think the two are any different. And I do think we need to break, and if you've been following what's going on in Israel now, there's an enormous amount of talk about that finally there needs to be a break. This living together, it just doesn't work, and it just creates more machlokas. Now, his antipathy to Kirov has nothing to do with his feelings to Chabad. That's quite interesting. We'll get back to that next time. It basically, I'll say it briefly, but I'll get into more detail. What does it mean to do Kirov? It means to leave the yeshiva. Now, if it was just the losers, or the ones who couldn't take it, that would be one thing. But instead, it's become an ideal. And as we can imagine that, the best and the brightest, that they go out to do Kirov. And I'll speak a little bit about that next class. And the Gedolim in America have certainly agreed that that's a positive thing, that we need to do Kirov today. But from Rav Shach's perspective, it's another example of putting in a foreign ideal. There's no notion of Kirov, he says. The notion is to sit and learn Torah. If someone comes into our Beit Midrash, then we can help them. But we don't send our best and our brightest out there to be with the Tumah of America. I mean, I'll show you next class. But you can go to the Eishet Torah website. Look at what they're discussing there. Sports. Entertainment, TV stars, all this. From Rav Shach's perspective, you're taking yeshiva bachrim and you're putting them in the midst of tumah, and you're destroying the whole notion of what it means to be a Haredi Jew because they're mixing with that. That's not what Kirov is. He says Kirov is when they come into our world and we're makariv them. He's very sharp, and I'll get into that. And there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. It was Eishet Torah. It's Eishet Torah that honors intermarried people at their dinners and things. I mean, Rav Shach, for him, this is incomprehensible. Or Sameach is very different. They don't go for this sort of stuff. Eishet Torah. If you go to their website, they have a whole thing about the State of Israel, about Zionism and all this. They're supposed to be a Haredi organization. So either they believe this stuff, which is possible then for Rav Shach, or they don't believe it, and they're just saying it to get money or to attract the non-religious, and that's even worse for Rav Shach, because then you're being mezayif the Torah. I'll go get into next class what he... I don't know how... And not only that, the Slifkin business. It's not just him. When the Gedolim in Israel found out what these Kirov institutes were teaching, what in their mind is no less than heresy. So we'll talk about that next class. But his view is not the view of the American Gedolim. The American Gedolim think just the opposite. Today we need to do Kirov. We have a chance to save these people. Rav Shach thinks differently, as we'll see.
And Mark, we'll let you go. I know people will keep asking questions.
Yeah, just a couple questions about Piscataway.
For those who live in Canada, of course, it is a holiday, but that means we can still all be here Victoria Day. And those who live in the States, of course, it's not. But anyways, thank you very much again
for your class,
and we'll see you all next week.
Now, let me just answer the last question.
Starting on Thursday.
Now, let me just answer David's question. And, Ares, you say Aish is affiliated with OU. Well, that's interesting. We'll talk a little bit next class. He did not write Piskei Halacha. He never wrote Piskei Halacha because he wasn't a posek.